Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Our host station is KALW Radio San Francisco. For the next hour, we're going to pretend that we are at Philosophy Corner. We've transformed KALW into a little part of the Stanford campus. We imagine ourselves sitting in a circle under the shade of one of Stanford's big oak trees.
Yeah, with a few friends. It's an opportunity to shed light, not heat, on issues that impact our life today. And today we're going to talk about the insanity defense, right, John?
That's correct, the insanity defense. You know, about 100 years ago, or maybe 130 years ago, Mark Twain said that nobody's guilty anymore, they're just insane. Is the insanity defense that big a deal these days, Ken?
Well, it's not that big of a deal these days. Not that many people really get off on the basis of the insanity defense. But Twain was living at a time when I guess it must have been some kind of rising tide, because 1843, there was this rule, the Macnaghten Rule, which is, I guess, still the basis of most of our legal doctrine of insanity. Can you maybe you can tell our listeners what the Macnaghten Rule is?
So you forgot the Macnaghten Rule.
It's kind of
Macnaghten Rule was actually something we owe to Queen Victoria. She was a little happy with how people unhappy with how a guy named John Macnaghten got off, and said somebody needs to think about this. She appointed a committee, and they came up with the basic idea expressed in flowery 19th century language I won't quote.
Yeah.
That if you're mentally ill, and on the basis of the mental illness, you either don't know what you're doing, like you kill somebody and you thought you were cutting out a paper doll, or you do know what you're doing, you know that you're killing somebody, but you no longer know that it's wrong. Like you're standing next to a policeman and you shoot someone, and the policeman says, "Why'd you do that?" And you said, "Was something wrong with that? It's not illegal, is it?"
Yeah.
If those kinds of ignorance are due to mental illness, then that's insanity. That's the Macnaghten Rule. It's still the rule in about half of the states.
Yeah, so we got different rules in different states. It's interesting you said that if you're ignorant, Aristotle had thought that there's two ways you could not be culpable for something. Either, you know, the wind can push you in the guy's direction and you'd knock him over and kill him, but the wind did it. You didn't do it, right? Or you can do it, or you act out of ignorance. You think a bear is approaching you, and you shoot the bear. Well, Aristotle wouldn't have shot the bear. You take your bow and arrow out, and you kill the bear with your bow. But it turns out it was your neighbor.
Then you're probably guilty of negligence for not being a little more careful. But you may not be guilty of murder because of ignorance. So, yes, according to Aristotle, if you do something voluntarily, you're guilty. But you can be excused if the particular thing, the particular upshot of your movement wasn't really what you knew was going to happen, what you thought was going to happen.
So the question we can ask is, what kind of thing is insanity? And how does sanity rob you of culpability? What does it rob you of, such that because you don't have it anymore, you're not culpable? That's the kind of philosophical question we want to ask.
Now, really, as a philosopher, insanity is a legal concept. The underlying question is really mental illness and responsibility. I mean, we might say, does the insanity defense make sense? There's been a lot of rethinking of it since the Hinckley case.
Yeah, John Hinckley got off by pleading insanity. That was pretty controversial. It was probably one of the more successful uses of the insanity defense. You remember Hinckley, John. That was President Reagan, right? This week, Amy Standen's examination of the insanity defense starts off with a recording of that assassination attempt back in 1981.
Shots rang out as President Reagan was leaving the hotel and about to enter his limousine.
On March 30th, 1981, John Hinckley opened fire on President Ronald Reagan, shooting four people, including the president, in front of the Washington Hilton. It was an attempt, he said, to impress the actress Jodie Foster. 15 months later, ABC's Carl Rochelle described the scene as the federal jury delivered its verdict.
The courtroom was charged with emotion as Judge Parker began to read the verdict. Count number one, not guilty by reason of insanity. A look of wonder came to the faces of John Hinckley's parents.
That's the count. The public was furious with the Hinckley verdict. An ABC public opinion poll taken that day found that 76% of Americans believed that justice had not been done. In the 3 years after the verdict, Congress and more than 20 states enacted laws limiting the use of the insanity defense.
The public has a completely ass-backwards view of the insanity defense in almost every regard.
Peter Aranella, a professor of criminal law at UCLA Law School, says that many Americans just don't understand what the insanity defense is.
The insanity defense is rarely litigated. It's a very unusual defense. When it's litigated, it's rarely successful. Juries hate the insanity defense. The word insanity, when it's used in the newspaper, Hinckley shoots the president and gets off because he's insane, and the public reacts, well, of course he was insane. You have to be insane to shoot at the president. They're using the word insane differently. They're using it as the equivalent of mental illness. But that really isn't the ultimate question.
The ultimate question isn't whether or not the defendant is insane. It's whether or not her insanity prevents her from understanding the moral significance of her actions.
The function of the insanity defense is to identify those hopefully unusual circumstances where a defendant cannot be fairly held accountable for his crime. It really raises a fundamental distinction in both law and morality, in which we try to distinguish between people who do evil and who are morally responsible for doing evil and people who are sick. And the criminal law doesn't want to blame the sick. It wants to distinguish between the mad and the bad. And that's a fascinating line to draw. Some argue you can't draw it. The law tries to draw it. Morality tries to draw it.
You could also argue that human behavior is really just a function of a person's life experiences, that we really can't be held responsible for what we do because we can't control what happens to us. In that case, someone from a violent or abusive upbringing, for example, doesn't have a fair shake at making moral choices, even if he's not mentally ill. Still, as complicated as human behavior is, the law draws a line at insanity, and according to Aranella, that's a lot better than the alternative.
Certainly law and morality, and I think defensibly so, draws such a distinction. And as a father of a severely mentally ill child, and as well as a beautifully normal child, I can tell you that the differences are rather dramatic. And I think they should have relevance to our moral talk and moral language and moral evaluation. So I think the criminal law is not on a fool's mission, and we should make distinctions between people who are morally responsible for their actions and people who are not.
This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy. Understanding people's moral responsibility is an important part of the philosophical discussion we're having. We don't want to have things asked backwards, as Aranella worries about.
Yeah.
I don't think we do. But we have to keep in mind that being sick or just being mentally ill isn't sufficient for application of the insanity defense. That is, you can be neurotic or psychotic and still know what you're doing and know what the law is, and then you're not innocent on grounds of insanity. So we need a little help here.
Yeah. Why don't we have Susan Wolf join us? She's joining us from radio station WUNC in Chapel Hill. Susan is the Edna J. Corey Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She works in moral theory and the philosophy of mind, and she's the author of a very good book called Freedom Within Reason. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Susan.
Thank you.
Hi, Susan. Susan,
Hi, Dan.
Susan, does the insanity defense make sense? Should people sometimes be exempt from punishment from moral responsibility for their actions because of mental illness?
And if so, why so?
Yes, it makes sense. I actually agree very much with Peter Aranella, as he was just aired. I guess there are two reasons why insanity ought to exempt you from criminal responsibility, at least certain kinds of insanity. First of all, it won't do the kind of good that punishment is supposed to do, to punish a criminally insane person. And second, the person doesn't deserve to be punished if he's criminally insane.
Yeah, you've got two different notions there, desert and sort of consequences. What do you say? So you suggest that we punish people to achieve some end or something like that, and we can't achieve that end by punishing an insane person. So help me think about why that's so. What is the end that you have in mind, and why is it that insanity makes it inefficacious, I guess, to try and achieve that end? Just help me think about that a bit more.
Thinking specifically of legal punishment, criminal punishment, the idea is that we set up some laws that are justified as a way of protecting the public from bad actions. And everyone is expected to know what these laws are and to restrain their action accordingly, with the knowledge that if they don't do that and they get caught, then they will be punished in a certain way. Well, if you have someone who's insane in the sense of the McNaughton rule, who doesn't know what he's doing or doesn't understand that what he's doing is against the law, right? Then, on the one hand, you can't expect him to control his actions according to the law because he doesn't even appreciate that they're applying to him in this case. Right? Moreover, he's not going to be able to learn from this because he won't learn not to do what the law tells him to do, because when he does the thing that he's being punished for, he doesn't think he's doing that.
Okay, Susan, but just with respect to the first one, the kind of the deterrence function of punishment,
right?
I would think, you know, if we had put Hinckley to death or incarcerated him in a prison for life, it might have well had some deterrent effect. People would say, look, even if you're nuts, don't try shooting the president, because the nation is very unforgiving about that. So, you know, all kinds of people are punished where it doesn't do them any real good. But if there's a deterrent effect, why not punish the insane?
Yeah, you won't deter the insane person, but you'll deter John.
Yes. Yes, right.
You know, or me.
Well, we have the basic system in order to deter people. The system says you will be punished severely for attempting to kill the president, right? The question is, what good are you doing by convicting and punishing an insane person who does that? The public is going to presumably be concerned about what will happen to them if they try to kill the president, right? And if they're not insane, then that's not, you know, the fact that we exempt insane people won't help them unless they can fake it, right?
John,
I should say, Hinckley, so far as I know, is still in St. Elizabeth's mental institution. It's not as if he got off in some happy or easy way.
He's being allowed sort of minimally supervised visits now, though.
Right.
So John Locke was looking at the question of whether people who were drunk should be punished for what they do, since they didn't really fit his criterion for punishment. And he said, no, we can't let drunk people off because it's so easy to pretend that you're drunk out of your mind. Is that a consideration here? I mean, we would deter people from pretending to be insane and doing things if we just said, oh, it's not a defense. You do the act, you pay the price no matter what your mental state was.
Right. In theory, that's right. And if there were empirically a problem of people often using the insanity defense and it working, then that would be a reason to consider, I suppose, the costs and the benefits of having that on the books. If Arenella is to be believed, that's not really a realistic worry. That's not what's happening, because the insanity defense doesn't work very well. There are a lot of other costs. You're actually risking a longer jail term you're risking longer confinement,
mm-hmm.
And so on. But there is also just the issue of what is a humane and just system going to do? And if you don't deserve punishment, a system that says we don't care about dessert.
Susan, we'll have to get to the question of dessert. That's an important question after the break. In a few minutes, we'll take some calls and your emails. Here's our question for you. Are obsessed people, other kinds of mentally ill people like Hinckley, responsible for their actions? Should they be treated or punished? Do they deserve it? Or does the distinction not make any sense at all?
And we invite you to join our discussion. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and hit the right button, and you can send us a comment. And we may read that on the air and answer your question that you send in by email.
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
Run, 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 run. Qu'est-ce que c'est indeed? Talking Heads and Psycho Killer. One of my favorites. I try to listen to that every year or two without fail. A fitting re-entry into our discussion of the insanity defense. I'm John Perry from Stanford's Philosophy Department, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, also from Stanford. Our guest is Susan Wolf from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and we'd like you to weigh in into this discussion. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our really cool website and click www.philosophytalk.org. You click on the comments button and send us a comment. We'll read it on the air if it's a good comment.
Ken, we're getting into this issue of dessert, and I know that you eat a lot of dessert.
Yeah, you can tell. Yeah, I keep expanding.
But in addition, you're a Kantian, so you undoubtedly have well-tuned thoughts about this. And Susan, feel free to jump in, but I want to give Ken a little bit of hard time here. What do Kantians think? We should just punish people because they did wrong, no matter whether it's going to do anybody any good or not. Is that right?
I don't know if I'm really a Kantian, but I mean, I want to go through the question about dessert. I mean, Susan hit on something, and we need to talk about it some more. It's not just the efficacy of punishment that's the issue. It's whether you deserve punishment. And there's somehow the idea that if you're sane and you do something morally wrong or criminally wrong, then the punishment is not just an effective means to achieve some social good, but you deserve it. You deserve it, you know. And if you're insane, somehow not doing it freely, autonomously, or whatever it is that an insane person doesn't have, somehow robs you of dessert for that to be punishment. To be punished. Now, what's the reason for thinking that? I don't know. Susan, can you help us out there? Can you think of a good reason why to say that an insane person does not deserve punishment? Not just that, you know, it can't be deterred. That's a purely pragmatic question. I assume that's not what you had in mind.
Right. No, it isn't. And again, thinking of insanity along the lines of the Macnaughton rule, a criminally insane person is someone who meets the conditions of either not knowing what he's doing or not knowing that what he's doing is right or wrong, then it would fall under the category of ignorance that Aristotle mentions. That, but actually, it's more serious than ignorance. I don't think we are off the hook if just because we're ignorant of what we're doing. As John said, it has to be non-culpable ignorance, because if there's negligence, you ought to know what you're doing, and if you don't, and if you don't take the responsibility of making sure you know what you're doing, then you're still blameworthy if what you're doing is wrong. Yeah. An insane person, on the other hand, is someone who isn't capable of finding out what he's doing in the relevant sense, and so there's nothing he could do or she could do to be in the position of being a responsible agent, and therefore, to blame someone for what he didn't understand he was doing, or to blame someone for doing something where it was impossible for him to understand why he shouldn't do it, seems unjust.
Take someone like Hitler, for example. Was he really capable of understanding that what he was doing was wrong? I mean, he was very screwed up. Out of touch with reality, in a certain moral reality. But, you know, I wouldn't think if we'd caught him, we'd give him therapy. I think he deserved, you know, to die painfully.
Yeah, you might be so gripped with an idea, Susan, so in the power of an illusion, like Hitler was, of the German superiority, that you can't know because of the power of this idea over your mind.
Do these delusional things count as insanity?
Well, I don't know whether we would call Hitler insane, but maybe we would. Maybe we should. And I think if we press it, if you convince me that Hitler wasn't able to know that what he was doing was wrong, something it would be hard to convince me of. But if you convince me of that, then therapy is not likely to work, but perhaps punishment is not really an appropriate response.
Let's see what some callers think.
Yeah, Susan, I just want to say, don't run for president because Dukakis gave an answer a little bit like that.
That's a little bit.
But philosophically, it was a good answer.
But Sanford in San Francisco is on the line. Sanford, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I think that in order to understand punishment, we also have to look at the fact that society needs retribution, and retribution is another aspect. I mean, it's what prevents people from taking the law into their own hands. If we know that what people are going to do is going to be punished because the society itself and the victim, which also is a society, needs to get even. And that's when all these other things make sense, is when you start to say, well, the world needs to get even, and the way, or the society needs to get even. Yeah. And then this all seems, you know, and that, I think, is the other missing part. It's not only deterrence, but retribution.
So let me ask how that goes, Sanford. Oh, you just said goodbye to Sanford. I was going to ask him if he meant that. Is it supposed to follow from that therefore you should punish the insane?
Yes. Okay. Well, you should punish the insane because you need also to let society, you know, societies make themselves whole by punishing for the point of retribution. I think that's the most accurate way.
Thanks, Sanford.
Okay, so Sanford was calling us at 415-841-4134. Now, Sanford brings up some terms. Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, but deterrence means you punish someone with the goal of keeping other people, or maybe that person himself, from doing it again. Retribution means you punish someone because they deserve it, and it really doesn't matter what society thinks. Even if society wasn't going to know that they were punished, it would still be your duty to punish them because they did wrong. Even if they had turned out to be in prison, you know, made themselves saintly, they would still deserve to be punished. Then there's a third thing that's sometimes a social cohesion idea, that society will fall apart if the state takes away the right to punish from individuals and then doesn't apply it itself. So there's kind of three different rationales that are slightly different for punishment, and I don't know how they bear on insanity.
Does John have that right, Susan?
Yeah, John seems to have it right. What Sanford, I think, was talking about, though, was not the retributive theory of punishment or justice so much as the psychological need, perhaps, or social need of people to get retribution. Right? I mean, it's not really, I mean, what he was suggesting is, look, we, the victims, or the friends of the victims, have a need to get even with these criminals and put them in jail. And that's not really the same as saying we deserve, that they deserve to be put in jail, so much as
we need
it's
them
a release
to be put
of our
jail.
Emotions, right?
Yeah,
it's kind
yeah.
of,
that, and I guess you would think
the expressive value of punishment, one might say.
The most standard theory of punishment is a mixed theory that says you should punish people if they deserve it and if it'll do some good, but you shouldn't punish them even if it'll do some deterrent good if they don't deserve it. That seems pretty reasonable to me.
Exactly.
And I suppose with insane people, the idea is if you really make the public aware of what you're doing, it won't have much deterrent effect. And if you take intent and knowledge to be requirements for dessert, they don't have dessert. So there's good reason to let them off.
There's good reason to let a caller in here. Eve in San Francisco's on the line. Thanks. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Eve.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that if we're going to assume that mental illness is physiologically based, which generally assumed a lot of mental illness is, then it's no more right to punish a person for committing a crime who's mentally ill than it is to punish a person who had a stroke while they were driving and caused an accident.
I'm not quite sure that follows.
If the person has an accident, causes a car accident while they're, because they've suffered from something physical.
I understand that.
Driving, then we don't punish them.
Right.
Because it's not their fault. Just as it's not the fault of a person who's psychotic who injures someone because they don't realize what they're doing.
I see what you're saying. Thanks for the call.
We seem to have kind of three different cases here, though. I'm driving along. I have a stroke. I slump over the wheel. The car turns, and I run over a child. It's a tragic thing, but you'd say it's not my fault. There, the action doesn't, the sequence of events doesn't really go through my mind at all. another case. I'm driving along. I'm just a cruel person. I see a dog I don't like, and I run over it. There, even if we think everything is physical, still it goes through my beliefs and desires. I ran over him because I wanted to. To me, that still makes a difference. I don't resent the person who has a stroke and runs over a dog, but I think the person who runs over a dog because they want to, even if the wanting is a physical thing, is pretty despicable.
Yeah, why don't you join us at 415-841-4134. We're talking with Susan Wolf, professor of philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Ken Taylor and my partner, John Perry.
Susan, you think it's if mental illness is physical, that's going to open the door to just kind of everything letting us off? Because after all, it's our bodies that are making us do it.
Well, I think mental illness should let us off anyway, and that the fact that it's physically based is really just helps make that case by. I think dealing with skeptics who think there's no such thing as mental illness, you could, if you really wanted to, you could get over this problem or take control of it. And whereas if we think it's a physical problem, we don't expect people to be able to get over it that way.
But let me ask you a question. I'm sorry, you wanted to go on, it sounds like.
Well, I wanted to take up John's example of the driver who runs over a dog because he hates dogs, and because it's going through his head rather than, a result of a seizure or a loss of consciousness, you think he's responsible. But what if what's happening is that he sees a dog and a dog triggers some, crazy thoughts in him, due either to insanity or to some kind of brainwashing scheme, so that he sees a dog and suddenly he's got visions of aliens invading, and he's got to run over the dog. It's going through his head. It's psychological, not loss of consciousness. It's through consciousness. But surely that's a case in which you think, well, he's not responsible for what he's doing. Something else is taking control of him.
Okay.
Yes, John?
I see that. But let me get you on the other side. I mean, I see your point against John. And it's a good point, but I want to get your point. I want to make a similar point against both of you, or maybe you. Look, everything that happens in me, everything that happens inside my head, is just a bunch of neurons pushing and pulling, and there's about a causal back and forth, and it makes me do what I do. And if you say the insane person couldn't help it, he couldn't know. Well, I have these beliefs, these desires, this character. It causes me to do what I do, and I can't change that. I mean, I'm not in control of all that. It's just stuff in me.
I'm not sure what to say, because I always wait for a Hume to communicate with me through the fillings in my teeth, and he's not talking to me right now.
Do you have an answer to Susan or to me? Or Susan, do you have an answer to me? It's all just causation. Deterministic stuff.
I'm inclined to agree with Susan that in that particular case. So it's not everything that goes through the person's wants and desires that makes him guilty. It's what we philosophers call a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition. Now, he's saying exactly when this kind of screwed up cognitive apparatus is screwed up sufficiently to get you off the hook. Well, that's what we're discussing, and that's pretty difficult. But I really wouldn't want to go along with Ken and think just because it's physical, nobody's guilty of anything, because there's too many obvious cases of people that are guilty of things and ought to be punished.
I'm trying to sort of isolate, though, what is it that a sane person has, Susan, that says, okay, you're culpable when you do something bad, but an insane person lacks that thing. I mean, what is the thing that we're...
About rationality, would that do?
Well, I mean, what depends on what you mean by rationality. I mean, it's just the ability to adjust means to ends. You could be insane and have that, couldn't you, Susan?
It's not just the ability to adjust means and ends, but also the ability to evaluate ends in some cases, I think. But let's just stick to the ability to adjust means to ends. There are kinds of insanity that if they don't involve... delusions or living in a fantasy world, and they don't eliminate the ability to adjust means to ends, then that may not count as criminal insanity and may not exempt you. It's not that any kind of mental dysfunction exempts you from responsibility.
Okay,
but on the other hand,
go ahead.
as you say, we're all physical beings. When you say, what does a sane person have that an insane person doesn't have? All kinds of psychological control over their behavior. And why isn't that enough to make a legitimate difference?
We'll take that question up after the break. Coming up after the break, the 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes, he looks at the man whose philosophical thinking set the framework for the modern insanity defense. That's St. Augustine.
So there's more philosophy talk after this short break. Please don't go away. We'll be right back.
Crazy for feeling so good.
Crazy, the great, great Patsy Cline, and a song written by the great, great Willie Nelson. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk.
And now I will demonstrate my wisdom by stepping aside to let Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, take over. Ian traces the roots of the insanity defense to the philosopher St. Augustine. So here comes the rapid-fire report. Ready? Go.
Ian Scholes, the insanity defense has its roots in English common law, which in the 13th century instituted the principle of mens rea, or guilty mind, the idea being that intended crimes are worse than unintended. Deliberately running over someone with your car is worse than hitting someone accidentally, and if you don't know you're committing a crime because you're not mentally capable, are you guilty? Insanity, in this sense, is a strictly legal term, not medical. Mens rea, however, has its roots even farther back. The law clerk who put it down took the concept from Augustine of Hippo. St. Augustine was born in a Roman town in North Africa in AD 354, in the waning days of the pagan empire and the emerging triumph of the Catholic Church. His father was pagan, but his mother Monica was a zealous Catholic who pushed him towards Christianity, where he eventually landed. He has a reputation for having spent a wild and sinful youth, but it's pretty tame by today's standards. In a famous episode from his Confessions, he remembers stealing pears as a boy. He wrote, quote, "What monstrosity of life and what abyss of death! Could I enjoy what was forbidden for no other reason except that it was forbidden?" Unquote. Why did he flog himself over a minor crime like stealing pears? Because he relished stealing the pears. He embraced the sin with a free will. He wrote this after a crisis of faith, his conversion, and his first becoming priest and then bishop of Hippo. Hippo became a kind of incubator of bishops, spreading Augustine's brand of Christianity all over Africa and eventually affecting the official dogma of the Catholic Church. Early Christians considered themselves fighters against the devil. Augustine moved that fight inward. His universe was God-centered, but he believed that only by perceiving the world and understanding it in the soul can we rise up to God. Since understanding is not inherent to humans, it therefore must come to us from an abiding source, once again, God. He was made bishop in a time of great upheavals, barbarian invasions, schisms, heresies, and nasty pagan diversions. There was a rival Christian sect called Donatism. Donatists believed that the church should be a pure island in a sea of evil, therefore known sinners should not be admitted. Augustine, believing that we are all sinners, in intention if not in deed, fought them. When Donatism was finally outlawed by the Catholic Church, its bishop in Hippo was removed and Augustine became its leader. Thus, he succeeded in starting Christianity in the road to actively changing the world rather than seeking to escape from it. Ironically, also helped sow the seeds of the Inquisition. I'm sure that was not his intention, though. No mens rea there. Augustine died in 430 AD. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher with a profile of the great St. Augustine. St. Augustine's one of my favorite philosophers, and I've always thought it's kind of sad that he seems to be responsible for a lot of negative things as well as his very clever thoughts. It's amazing how the consequences of actions, even a philosopher's intellectual actions, can go on and on and on. Your present philosophy hosts probably don't need to worry about inadvertently provoking an inquisition, however. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Susan Wolfe from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Susan, we were talking about sort of freedom and determinism. I was saying before the break, it's all just causing. And so I'm still trying to figure out, and it can't be just, well, it's in the insane person's brain. It's because all this stuff is just in our brain. So I'm still trying to figure out, what is it about an insane person that, you know, you said it's incapacity to know, but I mean, I can't be any different than I am. So what is it about an insane person that she has, you know, that a sane person lacks? Can you help me a little bit more?
Sure. Though maybe the first thing to say is you can be different from what you are, Ken.
Can I? Really?
Yeah.
You could
take up the guitar, for example, and or you could you know, look into how to build a bomb, right? Options you have.
If I had had a different upbringing and all that stuff, if my genes were different.
No, even with the upbringing you have. You could stand up on this a table that we're sharing here, take off all your clothes, and sing the Star Spangled Banner. You know how to sing.
Insane.
You know how to take off your clothes. You know how to climb up on a table. You choose not to do it, but you could do it.
So you say I have options that are open to me that an insane person lacks.
Yeah, they're kind of horrible to think about, but you do.
Is that what you're saying, Susan?
Well, yes, in a way, though, of course, most insane people have a lot of options. The question is, what are the relevant options when it comes to responsibility? What I think is that in order to be morally and legally responsible, what you need is, on the one hand, the ability to control your actions according to your desires and values, and on the other, an ability to revise or develop your desires and values in accordance with an appreciation of what reasons there are for developing them one way rather than another.
That's a lot. We've got a string of callers on the line that have been waiting for a while. John in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hi. I had the thought that children often have imaginary friends. And if you press a child, they can make the distinction between what you believe and what they believe. And they know that the imaginary friend is not real for you, but it still is real for them. And I think that insane people are not able to make distinctions. They may be able to say, oh, yes, I know that that's wrong. But in their world, in their minds, they're like that child with the imaginary friend and are not able to make that type of a distinction. And I think because of that they can't be liable for their actions in criminal ways, just as we don't hold a child liable.
That's a good comment, John. Thanks for calling. As I understand what John says, it would fit well into Susan's point of view. Susan says you have to not just be capable of means ends reasoning. That means being able to figure out how to do things and move your arm so that you are able to do what you want and walk across the street to get a Coke and stuff like that. But you have to be in touch with reality and not just the reality you're in touch with through your perceptions, but also fundamental values and what there is reason for doing and not doing. And so a child that can't distinguish their imaginary friend might be quite good at means and reasoning, but in a sense they wouldn't be in touch with reality. Is that basically the way you look at it, Susan?
Yes, it is. And that kind of example, as you say, is one I'm very sympathetic to. It portrays a kind of insanity that is out of touch with reality, and that if you understand that that's the way the person is, it seems immediately to suggest exemption from responsibility. The only thing that's difficult is that a lot of kinds of insanity, including kinds that are going to come up in criminal cases, aren't so easily understood along that model. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, Hinckley, for example, it wasn't really imaginary friends he was involved with. And so it's much harder to pin he had this obsession with Jodie Foster, who was a real person that he knew was a real person, and a president that he knew was a real president. And so it's just more difficult in these kinds of cases to say, well, there's something mentally malfunctioning here, but is it the right kind of thing?
Let's see if our callers can help us figure that out. Cheryl in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cheryl.
Hi. It seems to me that the point behind criminal law is more to punish the state of mind or the intent of the actor and not the action itself. For example, if someone were to die on the operating table, you don't charge the surgeon with murder because it wasn't his intent to kill the patient. And I think a case that's still bothers me is the case of Andrea Yates in Texas. I'm not sure if you remember that case, and I was wondering if you had any comments on
She
on
killed
that
all
case.
Those...
she a mother that killed five children?
Yeah, right. Comments on the Andrea
Yates
case.
Well, first comment is we're very reluctant to put mothers to death for killing their children. I mean, there's been several cases of that fairly recently, and that seems to be a case that provokes a certain amount of understanding of of insanity and being out of touch with reality. I don't know the details of what happened to Andrea Yates.
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't know the details of the case either. I mean, but it does raise a question, and Susan raised this question too, about you need a kind of detailed exploration of the mind of the person. And, you know, going back to this question of insanity as a legal concept versus sanity as a sort of mental illness, it's, you said at the very top of the show, John, that not all kinds of mental illnesses, you know, are sufficient for insanity. And if you look at the American Psychiatric Association, they don't claim insanity as one of their concepts. It's a concept of law.
That's right.
And some kind of mental illnesses may fall into that, but there isn't even a set of them that say, if you're this, if you're that, then you're definitely insane. So it's a murky area.
Yeah. Aristotle had this other category of where you can't help but doing something. And if you think about people who are very depressed, where maybe you can't do something that you... or you can't get yourself up to do something that you know you should do. I don't know about the Andrea Yates case, but I can imagine that you could have a case where somebody kills their children out of severe depression. I mean, that's the only really mental illness. And then I guess they wouldn't be insane by the legal standard.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. Let's take one more caller while we're getting toward the bottom of the show here. But Lynn in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lynn.
Hi, thank you. I think that some of you would be better informed if you had an experience where you were given a medicine that so radically changed your mindset that you would understand at least one kind of difference between what you consider to be your normal sanity and another possibility going on in your mind.
Why don't you tell us more about what you have in mind?
Okay. In the past year, I was hospitalized for some dreadful things that I don't remember because they gave me a drug to make me forget all that was happening to me and being done to me. And when I became conscious a couple of weeks later, I was left for at least a week with a lot of hallucinations that were very real to me. I mean, about my environment in the ICU.
So you can imagine doing something that later on, objectively, would look to you quite wrong, but you would have done it because of these very real hallucinations. You would have been an example of... ignorance of what you were doing and that you really didn't know the context in which your actions took place. Is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly. For example...
Thanks very much for the call, Lynn. We're getting toward the bottom of the hour. We're going to have to move on. Thank you very much. Susan, you have a last comment on Lynn's phenomenology of insanity kind of point?
Well, I think it's just another way of saying, you know, take seriously the idea that there are afflictions that really make you... unable to understand what you're doing or to be delusional about what you're doing. And when you take that seriously, the idea that such a person should be held responsible in the normal way in which we hold other people responsible, you know, just doesn't seem to make sense.
Thanks very much for joining. It's been a pleasure having you on Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for joining us. And I hope the snow doesn't hit North Carolina too hard today. It's hard to think of North Carolina as a snowy place, but I guess it is these days.
So, John, are you wise? Wiser? I mean, you were wise yesterday, but are you wiser?
Well, I understand, I think, the insanity defense a little bit better. And Susan strikes me as one of the more sane philosophers around.
Yeah.
We're reading one of her essays in my course on free will, and I think she's a very sound philosopher.
Yeah, she thinks sanity is a big deal. It's the basis of being able to ascribe moral responsibility at all. I think that's probably truth, but I think there's some deep questions still remaining that we haven't.
Well, maybe
quite
our
to.
Ideas will consolidate with a little music.
Yeah, music always helps the mind.
John, what's that drumming?
That's conundrumming, Ken.
What's a conundrum?
Conundrums are puzzles, something that bothers you, maybe just an intellectual puzzle or maybe something about your daily life. Ken and I will give you some philosophical advice. It probably won't help, but it may be amusing.
And we have a caller on the line now, John. Hello, Neil. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, gentlemen. How do you do?
Tell us something. Where are you calling from?
San Francisco.
You sound British.
Well, I am British.
Aha! I suspected as much.
So why don't you tell us your conundrum, Neil?
Well, my family is American, and I've been asked to consider citizenship. And going through the INS, it came to the attention of one of the INS officers that my green card was running out and asked me if I'd thought of citizenship. And I have, but there's one issue, and I mentioned that it seemed to be a Christian oath that you were required to undertake.
A Christian oath?
A Christian oath. The last four words are, "So help me God," and it's God with a capital G. And I explained I'm not a Christian. And the INS officer explained, well, you know, it's whichever God you believe in. And I explained, well, I'm not a theist. It doesn't apply to me at all.
This is the Oath of Allegiance. What do you have to say exactly?
The last line is, I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, so help me God.
Oh, goodness.
So help me God.
That can't be required by the U.S. Constitution.
Well, wrong again, Ken.
What happened to the separation of church and state?
I don't think God is in the Constitution, but he's definitely in the Declaration of Independence. Here's one way you could think of it. Suppose what you had to say was, so help me Sherlock Holmes. Would you object to that?
Well, yes. I take this very seriously. It's citizenship, and I would recommend everyone have a really good think about what citizenship entails.
Well, but I mean, all the important stuff is in there before. No evasion and so forth. So you've thought through citizenship and everything.
But here's the point, I think. John is a big fan of hypocrisy. He's told me this many times. Nobody takes this seriously, I think, that immigration officer was trying to say to you. Just do it. Just say it. Why do it seriously? Why take it seriously? I mean, maybe you're putting too much of a premium on sincerity and truth and all that.
Should I take the rest of the oath as not being very serious, too?
No. You're a clever guy there.
But before you take the oath, you just say to everyone that's there, now, I want you to understand, I'm not a theist. However, I do understand that when you say, so help me God, that means you mean it very seriously, and I am complying with that. And so when I say it, I will not really be referring to any omnipotent being of the Christian religion. I will just be assuring you with the seriousness of which I say it. Now, the practical effect of that, well, they'll look at you and say, come on, we've got people waiting in the next room.
Yeah, right. But get out of here, guy.
Wouldn't it help your conscience?
That's an interesting way to think about it. I hadn't thought about that. I'm a big fan of Nietzsche, and the way I began to approach it was that, you know, Nietzsche doesn't necessarily believe in God the entity, but more God the job description.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of have that job description. I mean, I made a key lime pie the other day, and I created it, and I destroyed it. I'm beginning to think of myself, perhaps it just refers to me, the God.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Now, Neil, you're starting to sound a little deluded. Just give it whatever meaning you want.
You can define the higher power however you want.
I hope that helps you, Neil, with your conundrum. Thank you very much for joining us on Philosophy Talk, Neil.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Each week, we end our program with a conundrum.
That's a riddle, a puzzle that shows up in your life that bedevils your mind. Now, we're not Dear Abby. We wouldn't try to be. But she doesn't have our philosophical background either, so there, Dear Abby.
Now, here's how you can join us with a conundrum. Send an email describing your issue to us, and you do that by going to our webpage. That's www.philosophytalk.org. O-R-G.
Now, when you do that, make sure that you let us know where we can reach you in case we decide to pick your conundrum for our program. Once again, that's www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the Conundrums button and look around at the other things while you're there, too.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Our production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jim Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, Alan Acosta, and Olga Kramer of Whitetail Web Designs. Our research team includes Neil Van Leeuwen, Lael Weiss, Josh Schneider, and Chad Carmichael.
Special thanks go to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from the Provost Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our funders.
For more information, visit www.philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.